Have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order. Would somebody like to approve the minutes from March 6th and March 11th?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
So, Representative Dean moves both sets of minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the minutes are adopted. The first bill up is Representative Clark Johnson, and it relates to bonding for the Minnesota Security Hospital.
Mr. Chair, yes. I'd like to move the bill. Can I move the bill?
Oh, yes, you can.
Thanks.
Move the bill.
Thank you.
So Representative Abler moves that House File 2067 be recommended to pass.
No.
I know, but we will, however, lay it over for possible. We refer to bonding. I can't read without my glasses. this bill will be ultimately just re-referred to the bonding committee. And Chuck Johnson is here from the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The Johnsons, are they related?
No, we were trying to investigate that, actually. I'm from North Dakota. He's from Wisconsin, but the Johnson family in the 1870s did settle first in Wisconsin before they found the golden land in North Dakota. But anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very important project to the state of Minnesota, and this is clearly a statewide project. What it does is rebuild and refurnish and reconstruct the security hospital at the Regional Treatment Center in St. Peter. This hospital serves mentally ill and dangerous Minnesotans, and the critical nature of the rebuilding is because the facility needs to be safer for our patients and for our state employees who work there. Both through resulting, because of the structure of the facility, it creates some disconnect in terms of programming. There are blind spots, and which creates an unsafe environment for the patients and the state employees. I'll just finish by saying this is, I consider this, frankly, a moral imperative, that it's absolutely essential that Minnesota provide a facility that is safe for its employees. No business would tolerate a facility that is not as safe as it can be, and nor should the state of Minnesota. And some of the problems with assaults, et cetera, I believe can be reduced through this rebuilding. So on behalf of the patients and the state employees, I hope this bill can pass. Thank you.
Mr. Assistant Commissioner Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I want to start by thanking Representative Johnson for bringing this bill forward. As I presented to the committee here a couple of weeks ago, I think, on this project, this is a project that is recommended in the governor's bonding package and that is the top priority for the Department of Human Services, both for bonding and in general for this legislative session, is to get the Minnesota Security Hospital bonding project passed. You should have in your packet a PowerPoint that looks like this. I think that might be where Lucy went, actually.
Distributed yet.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to just talk through. I did give you a full presentation a couple of weeks ago, so I'm not going to go to that level of detail again. But I will just remind you of some really important points that we think are critical in considering this project. As Representative Johnson said, the security hospital needs some significant restructuring, and this is a project that would involve some new construction, some remodeling, and some renovation of the existing facility. There are really three main points that we're trying to accomplish in this project. The first is to create a safer and more therapeutic environment for the treatment of other patients who are in the security hospital. This is really an imperative, we believe, because the security hospital as it's designed right now doesn't do a really good job of creating the kind of environment we need, particularly the kind of separation we need for people when they're in different stages of their treatment. I'll talk a little bit more about that, but that's a really critical need within the hospital right now that the current physical facility doesn't meet. it is our hope that by doing this reconstruction, we will be able to reduce the length of stay for patients in the hospital, which is right now about 8 years on average, and it's a wide variation around that mean. We want to reduce that to 6 years, and we believe with having this reconstructed hospital and the kind of facility that really supports different points, people in different points of their transition through, that we'll be able to do that. Also, creating a safer working environment for staff, which goes part and parcel with creating a safer environment for patients. We have a number of staff injuries that occur at this facility. That rate has gone up and down over the last couple of years, but has remained quite high. Some of those are very critical injuries. A lot of them are related to patients assaulting staff. Or staff trying to intervene in incidents that are happening with patients. Some of that is related to the physical environment, and we hope we can address that, and I'll show you a little bit more on that. And then also, finally, physically separating the patients that we're serving through security hospital programs from those patients that we are also serving on the St. Peter campus in the sex offender program. Right now in the lower campus, the lower part of the bluff on the St. Peter campus, we have a mixture of people in different buildings down there who are being served, either been committed to us as sex offenders or been committed to us as part of the security hospital's mentally ill and dangerous. That's not a mix that we want to continue with, and we feel that it's not a good place to have the vulnerable adults that are committed to us to the security hospital mixing with predators who are committed to us in the sex offender program. This proposal would move in two stages, and this bill supports the first phase of the construction. We'd end up with having all the patients in the security hospital being served on the upper campus so that we have separation from the sex offender program on the lower campus. Just a couple of more detailed pieces around what we're doing in phase one of the project. Phase one of the project, which is supported with this bill, is really supporting the initial changes we can make to support the most acute patients that we're serving us. In particular, the building of an evaluation unit so that when patients are first come into the hospital, first committed to us, we're able to keep them in a separate unit where we can evaluate what their needs are, get their medications balanced and appropriate before we move them out into the general population, figure out where they need to be within the broader facility. This is really critical to being able to get people stabilized before we start moving them into the population and treating them with other patients. Secondly, along with that, is creating a 12-bed crisis unit. Similarly, right now when we have patients in crisis, it's difficult to get them separated often from the general population. That not only doesn't serve well that patient who's in crisis, but doesn't serve well those other patients who are experiencing that patient who is in crisis. So a separate 12-bed crisis unit is part of the first phase of the project. We would also construct two new 20-bed housing units for acute patients, again, those who are most acute. Constructing some new housing. Now we'd also construct two 24-bed transition units. The transition patients are the ones that are currently on the lower campus. So this is the beginning of starting to move some of those patients off of the lower campus up to the upper campus so that we can begin the separation of the security hospital patients from the sex offender program. And then there's also some additional buildings we need for programming, a social center, a central plant, and a loading dock. And in the slide deck, you'll find a map of the upper campus on page 3. Gives you a visual of what that will look like when phase 1 is done, and then it's some dotted lines. You can see phase 2 as well on there. The dark building that is on there, that's the current security hospital building, and the white are the new buildings that will be new buildings or space that would be constructed in the first phase. And then, Mr. Chair, I won't go through the rest of this in detail, but you can see on slide 4 there's a second phase of the project. I talked about that a little bit when I was here a couple weeks ago. And then you'll see the pictures that, for those of you that have been here for the last couple of years, we've shared this presentation a number of times. The first slide here on page 5 shows you what a current living facility, living unit, looks like within the security hospital. And to the point that Representative Johnson made in starting the discussion here, really shows where we believe some of the danger comes from in the design of the building. The narrow stairways, the poor sight lines, the staff inability to be able to see what's going on a floor below them, but also the patient's inability when they're going down to their own unit, which might be on a lower level, to see what's around that corner if there's another patient or another incident going on. And then on slide 6 and 7, you can see what a kind of facility should look like. The top slide on page 6 is our facility in Anoka, And then on the bottom on page 7 there is a facility in South Dakota that our staff visited that was built by Avera. Both of these are secure environments for treatment of people with mental illness. You can see wide hallways, well lit, good visibility for the staff to be able to see what's going on around them, down in the living units, into the common areas and so forth. And that's what we want to construct for the St. Peter facility.
Commissioner, would you comment a little bit further? I met with some of the staff people, and they told me that about a third of the employees end up in an emergency room every year, and that in one facility where the most violent people are kept, almost 100% of the employees there end up in an emergency room at least once during the year. So this is a really... a serious issue, and I don't know what your workers' comp rates are, but my guess is they're pretty high.
Mr. Chair, we have some numbers we could share with the committee. We definitely have higher injury rates in this facility than you would expect to see, and based on industry standards, you do see in similar kinds of facilities. I haven't heard exactly the numbers that you're sharing from the employees, but those sound consistent with other stories I've heard about, particularly in some of the units where some of the more less stable and more volatile patients are, and the challenges for staff working in those units.
And I would just comment that this was designed years ago, the current facility, when these patients were almost all heavily sedated all the time, and they're not treated that way anymore. So the building as it was designed was probably okay for the dates or for the time, but healthcare has changed, and we need to have a new building. Any other comments? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I totally agree that this is needed to protect everybody who's involved on the campus. Since some of the money is for design and planning work, are you involving the families at all and figuring out how to better accommodate distance visiting? 6 to 8 years is a really long part of someone's life. And since most of the people don't come from the St. Peter area and can't necessarily always afford to come and visit the person that they're related to or friends with, are we upgrading our ability to have like video conference visits, those sorts of things? There was just an article about how just a phone call to someone in prison is $1 a minute, and I hope it isn't that same situation here where someone who suffered some brain trauma of some sort isn't allowed to have that support system from elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, from the Loeffler, I'm going to see if I can get any help from the audience on those questions. Mr. Ambuskirk.
Welcome to the committee, and would you state your name?
My name is Alan Bambuskirk, Facilities Director, Department of Human Services. Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are looking at, we're not looking at, but we'll be incorporating video conferencing technology to share for those that have that ability in the community with the patients, for those people that have to travel great distances. That's a concern of ours, to make sure that they have continual contact with their family as part of the healing process.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd encourage you to look even more broadly, like Skype access. Video conference facilities in the metro are just almost not known. But, in greater Minnesota, MinSU campuses and things like that, that may be more typical, but lots of people have access to Skype, telephone, those sorts of things, and just, to make sure that you can make that, because I think that's a very calming experience to feel like you're not totally disconnected from everyone else in your life, and that, too, will hopefully help with safety. And so I just want to make sure that we're, building rooms where if someone can't afford their own iPad or it isn't safe for them to have it, that there's a place for them to go. But I'd say video conferencing is actually kind of old technology, so keep looking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I just referenced video conferences, the broad area of video technology. DHS is a huge user of video technology, and we'll incorporate all the issues, all the technology that we can to support those in the community, be that Skype or video conference or video other video technology that may be available, so that we have the ability to make the relation, the family connections.
Great, thank you.
And could you spell your spell your last name?
V-A-N-B-U-S-K-I-R-K. Van Buskirk.
Got it. Thank you very much. Other questions? I don't see any, so next we have Sue Afterholden.
I'd like to introduce Matt Burdick.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, he's replacing, he will be representing NAMI at this.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Matt Burdick, Grassroots Advocacy Coordinator with NAMI Minnesota. Sue Afterholden is stuck over in the Senate this morning, so we're pinch hitting. NAMI
he
is.
Has my sympathy.
NAMI is in strong support of this proposal for many of the reasons that were raised earlier. The fact that people are at St. Peter for 8 years of their lives and that people are civilly committed there. So these are people with some of the most serious mental health challenges. And we've really seen that a safe and therapeutic environment plays a major role in people's recovery and actually can help hopefully reduce the length of time people are there and help people get back on their feet sooner. The recent upgrade to Regents Hospital has actually shown a decrease in the use of seclusion and restraints. And some of the recent news reports at St. Peter, we're hoping that maybe similar things could result at this facility as well. We know there are broader issues that need to be addressed, but we think this is a very important first step to really improving the care people are receiving there. So encourage you to support this proposal. Thank you.
Questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, do you have any final comments?
Mr. Chair, just simply to say that this project has remarkably strong support from the larger community. And when I say the larger community, I would say the region where I live. And particularly, it has strong support from the employees and the staff and management and staff at the Security Hospital. I want to just stress that the Phase 1 work is indeed a top priority that I've heard from the security counselors who are represented by AFSCME. Both staff and management and staff would be here today, but they're working hard in St. Peter to care for our neighbors. And so they were unable to come. But I think there's many of you have heard from them over the years. This is a top priority for those folks, and I just ask for a favorable report on this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. I would say the strong support goes all the way to the city of Duluth. So with that, I would renew Representative Abler's motion that House File 2067 be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
You.
All those in favor, excuse me.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, next we have House File 1224, Purcell. Yeah. Welcome to the committee, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members,
Okay, I would move that House File 1224 be before the committee, and then when we get done, I will move that it be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with your indulgence, I have a oral amendment I'd like to propose here. We got a couple of words that need to be corrected.
Okay. Tell us what they are.
And this is on line 1.8 of the bill, where we're talking about the grant going through Office of Rural Health and Safety, and what that should read Office of Rural Health. I'm sorry, Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. Yep. So we'd be striking safety and putting in primary care. That's the correct
name. So you got
name.
Sean Bond's correct the office that he heads up?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All those, I will move that amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So the amendment is adopted. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1224, this is a request for $190,000 to the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe to upgrade their ambulance service so they can achieve a licensure termed advanced life support. And I'm not going to get too far into that. It's been too many years since I was in that particular field, like 40 years ago, so things have changed. So I have with me Mr. Buck McAlpin that would tell the committee more about what that means.
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We got asked to get involved with this just to help Leech Lake with the requests that they have. They are a basic life support ambulance. As we've talked before, still about 60% of our EMS system is volunteer or basic life support. They're kind of in a area of the state where everybody knows where that area is up in Cass County and Leech Lake that they don't have a lot of access to advanced life support to back them up. The closest one's probably Walker or Longville, and you can't get anywhere on the roads to Longville. So our Ambulance Association always supports assisting services and upgrading. Very low volume, very nice volunteer base that they have there. They have some folks that have trained to the paramedic level. The difference is about 120 hours of training as an EMT to about 1,400 as a paramedic, and it would allow them to do some advanced skills in their community. Endotracheal intubations, more fancier stuff with their defibrillators and heart monitors, carry drugs on their ambulance, and be able to do some interfacility transports that they haven't done before because the skill level's there. And usually we find in rural Minnesota when we add a paramedic that's paid and staffed to an ambulance, it usually has that ambulance stay more viable and more available 24 hours a day. And we always think it's a good idea to upgrade these. It sounds like a lot of money, but the equipment's quite expensive. Those defibrillators run between $20,000 and $25,000, and by the time you equip a full-time ALS ambulance truck, it's quite costly.
Okay, any questions? Don't see any. With that, do you have any final comment to represent yourself? Nope. So. So the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Mr. McElfine and Representative Purcell. Next is House File 1831 with Representative Fritz.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you again for having me here. And I do have Bill Straczynski, who's going to join me here. And thank you for hearing this bill in this committee. The purpose of House File 1831 is to provide reimbursement to licensed independent clinical social workers for psychiatric consultation to primary care practitioners regarding mental health treatment. Do we need to move the bill?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Got carried away. I'd like to move the bill.
So, Representative Fritz moves House File 1831.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Social workers provide an array of varying mental health services and have skill and training in assessing, treating, and preventing psychological, behavioral, emotional, social, and environmental problems affecting the consumers in mental health care. Licensed social workers are pursuing reimbursement for consultation with primary care currently. Currently, psychologists can be reimbursed for consultation to primary care providers. Clinical social workers have mental health ability and expertise in diagnosed health, psychology, interdisciplinary planning and care, case management and clinical treatment planning, all of which can be both very useful to primary care providers and necessary and impactful additions to treatment. It is important and necessary that licensed social workers are reimbursed for their services. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bill Straczynski for some comments.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Minnesota Society for Clinical Social Workers. I think that's the correct acronym. In any event, Mr. Chairman, to cut to the chase, this bill is very similar to what you passed last year on behalf of psychology. Psychologists is reimbursement from the Department of Human Services, and they provide many of the same services. In their clinical practices, they interact with physicians. We want them to interact with physicians, medication, and what have you. Adjustments in nursing homes. The primary care provider is helping with that. The clinical social worker is helping with that. They should, too, be reimbursed for those services. So that's the essence of what the bill does. I do have with me, there was a fiscal note prepared last year for this issue, for clinical social workers, as an amendment to another bill. There was no separate bill last year. We introduced this the last day of session. But the fiscal note from the Department of Human Services as to that amendment, basically, which this bill does, they assume that the addition of licensed clinical social workers expands the scope of these consultations to apply to a broader range of mental health issues. We anticipate the addition will result in an increase in the volume of payments to licensed clinical social workers by 0.5% by fiscal 2017. I think the numbers basically were 23,000 or 24,000 for FY 2014, 46,000 for 2015, 69,000 for 2016, and 92,000 for 2017. So, for what it's worth, I don't know if staff has this. No, I found it late last night. So, but that's the impact of that. And we appreciate the committee's favorable consideration of this request.
Mr. Straczynski, could you clarify for me what independent clinical social worker means as opposed to a clinical social worker?
Mr. Chairman, I think licensed independent clinical social workers is the term, and it deals with the amount of education they have and the training specifically they have to deal with these issues, part of their court practices. But I think there's a distinction in the number of hours that occurs between these different types of practitioners. We want to make it clear that this bill basically deals with licensed independent clinical social workers who are doing providing mental health consultation services.
The one thing I've learned here in the last 10 years is, depending on the person, you can't separate health care from their social needs as well, and it's nice to have some coordination on that.
Mr. Chairman, we think that's really important because you want to encourage that kind of coordination to help people make these adjustments in life. I agree.
Any questions? Don't see any. Is there anyone else wishes to testify on this bill?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, for the record, my name is Henry Erdman, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Licensed Marriage and Family Therapists. We support the bill. As you can see by the language drafted, an amendment was added in the policy committee to add licensed marriage and family therapists to the bill. Marriage and family therapists are uniquely qualified, trained, and practice from a relational and systems models perspective, which naturally includes skillful interdisciplinary communication and consultation to primary care practitioners, a practice they embrace early in their care and treatment plans, and we would encourage your adoption and consideration of this bill for the Ombuds bill. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Erdman? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. You have a final comment, Representative Fritz?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And I have my youngest daughter is a social worker with the hospice program, and I worked in the nursing home with the social workers. And believe me, we need them, and they do a lion's share of work for us. And I'm very happy to have this bill before us today to help them with reimbursement.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Well, just before you run off here, this is the Finance Committee. I actually talk about finance. On the fiscal note, I just saw it here. Is there any, maybe Mr. Berg knows the answer, is there any deduction for what we don't have to spend when we do a good job of what the bill is supposed to do, or is it just all cost that they're charging us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, this is a preliminary fiscal note on this year's bill, mm-hmm. so the costs members will notice are a little different than Mr. Straczynski mentioned. I literally got this like 10 minutes before the hearing, so I have not read the narrative on it. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a deduction. I will have to read through the note a little more carefully to...
Mr. Chair, I just see some of the DHS staff in the audience. I know they love coming on talking fiscal matters, but you know, we're not running very behind. We're running ahead of schedule. Could we spend a minute talking about how they do their fiscal notes and the deduction part, or is that a...
Would somebody from the department like to come down?
I mean, we're paying their time anyway, so might as well get the money's worth out of it.
I make friends and would influence others by Jim Abler.
Yeah. And... would you sort of reserve your comments to this particular bill?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick Holtman with the Department of Human Services. I have with me Steve Masson, who covers sort of the policy area. We just are not clear on what mechanism we would use to assess savings in this bill. It's an added covered service, and we didn't see a reason to look at that kind of reaction, I guess, or that kind of phenomenon, I guess, to add savings.
Okay. So thank you, and Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chairman and members, I also feel like I need to clarify that this comes up frequently in fiscal notes, this exact issue of secondary savings, and both the department's view and it's in the fiscal note manual that unless there's some way to specifically document savings, we don't look at secondary impacts. So I know members often think, particularly in this committee, that you know if we're doing something here, it ought to save us some money, and maybe it will. But unless you can really document that this set of individuals will not receive some service, you generally cannot include it in a fiscal note.
And Mr. We don't have George Hoffman to kick around anymore.
I know. So I'm just trying to help in the new generation, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
And so just in the process, and this is actually a good case in point, because if you listen to the testimony, you just got to think this is going to save some money and there's going to be some use reduced. And if you would talk to some of the, especially as the ACOs start to take more, take more root and there's total cost of care, we're going to see that some of these kinds of projects actually do save money. There's even a pilot project that we did where we have a social worker in the ER, yep. and that has actually shown to save money. And so it seems like there's data out there, at least on the theme of this. And I'm glad we can at least discuss it for a moment. The school shift got paid back halfway by unexpected savings from our area that we knew we were going to save money that we didn't get credit for. And if we would have known that would have happened, we would have actually either reallocated the funding to a waiting list or at least known what we were going to be really saving. And so just to encourage you as you go forward, if a member would bring to you some evidence that there could be savings and maybe some of these pilots that are going forward, you're not close to it. You just need some reason to believe that it might be some savings. I appreciate that. And so maybe, Mr. Chair, as these fiscal notes come out, then the members could be encouraged to provide additional information, and then it'll be duly considered by the department. I know you guys work hard, and we balance the budget by the Constitution based upon your best opinions, and I know it's a heavy duty, and I have a lot of respect for you guys. So. Thanks for daring to come down to the table.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I will say that when we passed the medical homes thing in 2008, I believe, it took till this past fall for them to figure out there was saving 9%.
9%. Could have had a V8, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you.
So, Representative Britt, any other questions?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and also Representative Abler. That bill you referred to was a bill that we passed. It was a bill I carried through here, the pilot program down in Owatonna, the social workers there, where they had many frequent flyers plugging up the emergency room. With many, many people and not being able to care the way for all of the folks down there. So that program saved $200,000, the first time that I saw a savings ever in that area. So I'll be sure to keep a close eye on this and hopefully have some more savings to report to this committee and the rest of you in the future. Thank you.
Okay, this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Fritz, you have the next bill, House File 1295.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do, and I do have a couple of testifiers who will join me here.
Move the bill first.
I would like to move House File 1295.
Okay.
All right.
And do you have an amendment?
Yes, we do. And I'm going to actually have my testifier discuss those amendments. For this bill, actually, we had before policy, I think a week ago. And we thought we had agreements, and originally it was designed to grandfather in people on the elderly waiver, and the department then has since told us that there's some changes, and I would like to at this point turn it over to Mary Jo George from AARP and Ann Henry also, who could discuss these amendments and make sense out of this.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to testify. As Representative Fritz indicated, the House File 1295 originally was going to grandfather in seniors who were losing coverage under the elderly waiver program due to the nursing home level of care changes back in 2009. And we were doing this, we thought, to be consistent with current law that would allow seniors who are in nursing facilities to retain Medicaid long-term care payment. But the department has told us that was not their intention, and so these seniors in nursing facilities will also lose the coverage as well. So we think it's very important that we look at ways to mitigate the harm to this population. We've also been talking with Ann Henry at the Disability Law Center, and we have concerns about persons with disabilities who are on our CADI waiver too, since these changes do impact people, seniors on elderly waiver, and seniors in nursing homes, and persons with disabilities. And so what we do in this, instead of grandfathering these folks in, we do four changes. On the first part, section 1, line 2.2, we modify the level of care criteria. So under the law, a person is eligible to continue with this service if they are at risk of self-neglect. And so what we do is we clarify that self-neglect would be applied to a person who is losing their housing and has no suitable place to live within 30 days. Because one of the concerns is, many of these seniors may have sold their home, moved to an assisted living, and don't have an appropriate low-income housing place to live. So that would be some clarifying language. Section 2.
One moment. I'm just going to interrupt. That's the DE1 amendment that she's explaining. Okay.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Section 2.
Let's move the amendment now that we've explained. I'd like to move the DE.
Fritz, okay. Representative Fritz moves the DE1, which is a delete all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
I'll continue. Thank you. Section 2, starting on line 2.24, what we do is we increase the amount of time somebody can appeal these benefits from 10 days to 30 days, and we require that the notice must include information, for example, on what other services are available. Number 3, section 3, line 3.21, this will allow those who are losing services to be both eligible for personal care services with essential community services. And I think Ann Henry can speak more to that, but the problem we have is that waiver program has been very robust, and if you're just now getting personal care services, you won't have access to case management. You won't have access to home-delivered meals. So this change would allow those people to have both of those services. And finally, the fourth one in Section 3, line 3.27, does increase the essential community grant program by $100, from $400 to $500. We are continuing to work with the department on the utilization of data. You know, it has been our belief that the data that these folks are using more. However, we want to continue working with the department to make sure we are meeting the target there. So with that, I think I will hand it over to Ann.
Representative Loeffler, do you want to ask a question now or wait till Ms. Henry gets
there? Well, Mr. Chair, the question is about the amendment, and if you're the I think it's in the part that Ms. George has actually been involved with, and that's a line 2.2 to 2.3. I understand the intent of the bill and the amendment, and I think it's good, but I think this really opens a much broader door than maybe you intended, because I think many of the people who are in homeless shelters and other situations would now have eligibility for nursing home level of care or admission, and I'm not sure that that was the intent, but maybe I'm reading it wrong. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, we could continue to talk to the department about that. My feeling is that what you have to do is first meet the nursing home level of care in subdivision 11. Well, actually, yes, you would have to meet the level of care. So subdivision lays out, you know, all the criteria needs. So the person would require formal clinical monitoring once a day. They would need assistance of another person in at least four activities of daily, you know, living. So this sort of modifies that section. And I wonder if Ann, maybe you would want to speak to it too.
Ms. Henry.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, the intent, and it may be that we need to fine-tune this a bit, mm-hmm. is that for people who are now in residential settings on Elderly Waiver and on the CADI program, and we are getting data and we have it, I don't have it in front of me right now as to how many people, it's a relatively small number, that these folks, when they get their notice that they're terminated, are going to be at risk of homelessness, and that the department has told us the way that they mm-hmm. they want to avoid that. They've been very clear they don't want that either. And the way that they would avoid it is assess whether the person is at risk for self-neglect, mm-hmm. which is one of the categories qualifying you for a nursing facility. So our intent is to have this applied to people in the transition population who are already living in these settings and have their lives set, and then they're terminated. And we don't want those folks to end up to be homeless. So it may be that this needs more refinement to be sure that it is for those in the transition population, because the intent was not to expand to the population that you're talking about. I don't think people necessarily who are homeless are going to be wanting to qualify for the nursing facility level of care.
Representative
Mr. Chair and members, I think they've, but if that's your only place to get out of a 40 below wind chill, I'd take it in a heartbeat. and so I think we do need to work on it, because it's just meeting one of the following criteria, and you might want to ponder including a loss of currently used licensed housing, you know, something that kind of makes it clear that this is really about this transition group,
yes,
and not about creating a new opportunity, for a population that we didn't intend to pick up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, if there's somebody from the department who would like to comment, they could come down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Jean Wood with the Department of Human Services, and is it on this last discussion that you would like us to comment, or on the entire amendment?
Both.
Both. Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, it was our intention, this piece appears in the persons in transition section, and so it is, as Ann Henry stated, it is the intent that this impact only people who are in the transition group, and those are people who are already eligible, receiving services under Elderly Waiver, Alternative Care, and CADI would be eligible for having their level of care retained for the reasons of potential homelessness. So, but we will look at it again.
Okay.
We
have any comments on the whole delete all amendment?
Mr. Chair, we have been working with the stakeholders to bring it to the point where Representative Fritz and the stakeholders want it. We think that we have accomplished this while avoiding a grandfather clause, which, as they've said, CMS would not permit us to have. So we think we have accomplished that. We will continue to work on it and make sure it accomplishes that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. Yeah. And I have another question that I had before. But so, Ms. Wood, welcome back.
Thank you.
So we can't have a grandfather clause? I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Ms. Wood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, no, we are not permitted to have a grandfather clause because you'd be treating people who are eligible for the same benefits differently.
Yeah.
And you can't take a population and treat them differently than the person sitting next to them.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That certainly complicates matters. I missed the first intro. We were haggling about fiscal notes here in the beginning of Representative Fritz's intro. But is this part of that? Is there a governor's proposal on this in his budget where he spent some money to deal with this? Or is this just a project by people who are worried about this and hoping we find money?
I don't believe the governor has a project. I think this is...
It was just one year delay.
1 year delay. I'm sorry. I misspoke.
So I just wanted to clarify that. So, Ms. Woods, the governor delayed it for a year, hoping something would happen, but himself didn't present any idea about how to change things in the year. Is that correct?
Ms. Wood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there was a belief at the time that this was coming into implementation that not all alternatives were available in the community as we had anticipated, and so that was the reason for the governor's and the department's delay.
And Mr. Chair, I read somewhere that we did pay for essential committee supports twice. I brought that up, and I thought, where's my million, my $999,000 that I took out of all our terrible short monies? And at least I was happy to find out that I was right about that. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz, and to the advocates, this has got a pretty good-sized fiscal note here. And I don't know what target the good chairman's going to have. A lot of people want some help from him. It's actually at least nice to have money to spend and have less than you had before. But so now everybody's your best friend, aren't they, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, I believe that fiscal note was when we were going to grandfather them in, so it included that. So that's...
So this is less.
Disregard that. We will get a new fiscal note.
Well, thanks. Hey. And just to comment on the whole thing, when I was part of passing this both times through huge support on a bipartisan basis, mm-hmm. and I don't think we realized that we were turning people away that were going to be in a place. I think that never was in my head anyway. So I'm happy to be part of the solution, and I hope you can find the money to do the good work. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
Further questions?
No.
Any other testifiers? I don't see any. So, Representative Fritz, I will lay your bill over. Okay. She renews her motion to adopt the amendment. The DE-1. So, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the DE-1 amendment is adopted, and now we have the bill as amended, which will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And with that, I think we're done now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. I appreciate your support.
So with that, the meeting is adjourned.